Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have a very special guest. He's the author of many, many, many best-selling books, and the current one of which is The Sixth Man, one of his best. And take it from me, it is published from Grand Central, and his name is David Baldacci. Hello.
Hello.
What an honor to have you on the show.
Yeah, it's great to be back.
You're always nice. Every time I see you, I've met you three or four times, I guess. You're always so pleasant, and is it your Virginia background that makes you so easygoing?
Yeah, I'm sure it's part of that, and you know, good parenting, being raised, and you know, just you respect people, and you're mannered and polite. And it would be very, very difficult, very hard for me to be mean and nasty to people. I'm just not going there. It's not who I am.
And you're always smiling, and I know you're a busy guy because you write two books a year now.
Yeah, I am busy, but I like, you know, I like taking the time to talk to people who love books and readings. And people ask me, why do you still go out on tour? You don't have to do that. And I say, well, primarily I go out there just to meet readers and, you know, see, talk about books, see what they like, what they don't like, and just it's a pleasant atmosphere. And I like interacting with fans as much as they like interacting with me.
It is a wonderful thing to be in the midst of people who really enjoy you and enjoy your writing. And This Sixth Man is one of my favorites of yours. And
oh, thank you.
Really, really terrific book. Tell me the genesis of this book. What do these plots just come to you in the middle of the night, or how do they come to you, or do you read newspapers, or how does this come about?
Well, it's always good for a writer to be very curious about things, and I certainly am. And I'm a voracious reader of anything that's out there that seems interesting, politics, government agencies, the intelligence field. So I sort of focus on the intelligence field here because just people I know in the field and things that I've read and things that I've experienced, it's just kind of a mishmash right now. And I think some of the results we get or don't get can be blamed on the fact that oftentimes we have too many intelligence agencies, too many people doing the same thing, and it's kind of not focused and not integrated, and people don't share information. So I thought, let me build a story where I kind of flip the intelligence scenario on its head, and I'll do a different take where I get one guy who is tasked to know it all, and he's the one who can set policy and make us really focused, and all the agencies have to share their information, and everything's integrated, so the whole picture is out there for one guy to sort of look at and try to solve. So I had that set up, and then I obviously complicated it by, you know, this guy Edgar Roy is tasked to protect us. Now he's accused of being a serial killer, and he's sitting in a prison, which isn't any help to America, but if he is a killer, then it is what it is. And I thought it would be a good vehicle also, because I'm always thinking about the series that I have. This would be a good vehicle for my King and Maxwell duo to come in and try to solve. So with that sort of gist in mind, I started outlining it and started researching and talking to people in the fields and writing the story. It's not a precise formula how I do this, and I kind of attack books different ways, and there's no one-size-fits-all. But for The Sixth Man, that's really what I was thinking.
And it works out so beautifully. It's just a wonderful story. It's one of those books. I gave it to somebody at the bookstore I work at, and she came into work one morning. She's like, I can't stop reading this book. You know, she was all like excited about getting back to the book. I mean, that is the joy of reading, that you can't wait to get back to the book. And when somebody says that about your book, it's got to be a great feeling.
It is. It's the best compliment that a writer can receive, because it's hard to keep people's attention with little printed symbols on a page, which is all I have in my quiver. You know, I don't have, you know, sounds. I don't have big pictures on a screen. I don't have moving action, which, you know, human beings sort of relate to that a little better, because it's out there. You can actually see it. You don't have to spend any time imagining it. So to really enthrall somebody and wanting them to get back to a book when they're away from it just because it's just a bunch of words strung together, that is quite a compliment. And as a reader, you know, aside from a writer, as a reader, when I have that same feeling when I want to rush back and read a book at the end of the day, or I'm looking forward to it after dinner or before I go to bed, it's a very comforting feeling, because, you know, I'm going to spend a little time with something I really love to do, and it's just a nice way to spend your time.
Now, I don't know how many hours a week you spend writing. It's got to be quite a bit to have two books. I know you're one that's coming out in the fall is called Zero Day.
Yes.
Which I always get interested in your books when I hear the titles. I think, I wonder what that's about. Right away, the reader's like, well, what's it all about? Who's going to be in the book?
Right.
And, I mean, I love Sean. And,
yeah.
And Michelle, I just think they're wonderful. This is like the fifth book they've been in, but there's something about those two, you know, the way they interact with each other that's really interesting, and you can't wait to see what they're going to do next. Now, you do a lot of, I mean, you do the Camel Club, and then you do standalones, and you actually have another book called One Summer coming out this summer, actually, in a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So you do a lot of different things. Did you ever at any point... Would you, What I'm thinking is, why do all these different series? Why not just do one series? Is it because you like to do different things?
Oh, I think so. It's, you know, having one series, I think, and some writers do, and they do very well with that, and that's fine. For me, I just kind of have a lot of different interests and a lot of different subject matters that I like to write about, and not all of them would be suitable for a certain set of characters like the Camel Club. You know, for them to have been in the Sixth Man would have been a little unwieldy, you know, five or six people running around doing things.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So I like, you know, sort of taking different, and also it's just because sometimes you get bored with certain characters, you want to write something fresh. That's one reason why I started the King and Maxwell series, because they were a fresh sort of dynamic duo that had interesting personalities and a hell of a lot of chemistry. And the Camel Club, it's just because it's very idiosyncratic group of guys that are the most unlikely band of heroes you'll ever see. That was interesting for me. I wanted to spend time with them. Then I have standalone books where I can develop totally new characters and bring them to bear on a certain story that I might find interesting. And
do you ever get them confused? I mean, is it difficult to keep them all separate and all?
No, it's almost like your kids. You know, I never confuse my kids, even on a bad day, because you created them and you know everything about them. So it's very easy to, in my mind, to keep them straight. You know, occasionally if I'm writing, you know, the fifth book where something happened in the first book with the Camel Club where I mentioned something about a character, their background, or whatever, I do have to go back and reread portions of that because I can't remember every little detail and I want to be consistent. But for the big stuff, you know, and the big background, the big sort of things they've done in their life, obviously their names, that's something that's sort of indelibly impressed in my mind.
I guess for some writers who write different things with each book or write a standalone for each book, that must be easier for them because they don't have to go back and see where the character was or remember certain details about a character, because the readers know everything. The readers always remember all these little details that you may forget. But
that's right, and that's a benefit of, you know, sort of creating a fresh world each time. You don't have to do that, but also the added work is you have to create a fresh world each time and a fresh backstory for all the characters. And so I kind of like going back and forth, because sometimes with like Zero Day, brand new standalone character, beginning of a series, a new guy, so I'm putting a lot of time into his character and building in backstories that I can elaborate on in new books going forward. But for me, it was kind of fresh because I'd written a Camel Club book, I'd written a King and Maxwell, recurring characters, where I didn't have that challenge. And now with Zero Day, that's a fresh challenge for me. Okay, I have to recreate a whole new world out there. And for me, it was fun. It was very satisfying.
It's funny, you go online to look at the book, and there's nothing written other than it says it's coming out November 1st. There's no plot or anything. And as a reader, you always want to know, oh, I wish I knew what the book was about. We always have this curiosity about what the book's about. Why are they keeping it such a secret, you know?
Well, with Zero Day, the title comes from the fact that the lead character is a guy named John Puller, and he was an Army Ranger, and now he's an Army CID agent, which means he's a criminal investigator for the Army. And I put him into a scenario where he's off post, having to investigate this case that has a military component to it, but it's also a civilian component in the middle of nowhere in West Virginia, so he has to work with the local cops. And the Zero Day aspect comes from the fact that, one, it has a little bit something to do with the plot, that phrase Zero Day. And secondly, Zero Day in military parlance is used to refer to a recruit's very first day in the military. You know, that's when the truck comes and picks you up and takes you away from mom and dad. You belong to Uncle Sam. So, because this was the beginning of a series for John Puller, this is sort of his first day on the literary page. So I thought it was a nice symmetry there.
Now, you've been very successful with the Camel Club, and there are going to be more Camel Club books?
Yes, there are. Everybody loves the Camel Club. They really do.
And how about the True Blue series? I actually like that series, too.
Oh, I do. Mace Perry will be coming back. I really left it open-ended at the last book, the first book I wrote with them. And that's also being developed for a network television series.
Oh, wow.
That I hopefully will make it to the screen. And Sixth Man as well. I optioned that for another company that does the Bourne Ultimatum movies. Optioned that to develop that as a network television
series. Now, do you get involved in those developments? I mean, do you get a say on anything in there?
I'm involved in it. You know, so when they get to the point where, you know, they'll be casting and they have discussions about what the first episode's going to be, the pilot's going to be, then yeah, I'll be in there talking to them about that.
Now, the Sixth Man, who do you see as playing Sean and Michelle? Do you see anybody, is there anybody in your mind that looks...
Yeah, for television, no, because I'm really not up on the people in the television field who might be. You know, this could be two brand new character, you know, actors that make their name playing these roles. That would be kind of cool. I thought if it was going to go to the big screen, that, you know, having George Clooney as Sean King, Angelina Jolie as Michelle Maxey kind of cool, but, you know, that's pie in the sky, right, stuff. So that's why I'm not a casting director. I just don't know.
I mean, this is now one of my favorites of your books, The Sixth Man. I'm not just saying that lightly because we're talking about it. This is just one of those books you could, like I said, you can just delve into and enjoy. And I, you know, you never know with an author whether you're going to get that every book.
I mean, no, you don't. And you really don't.
Even the big authors, you think, well, I can trust them because I've read what they've done before. They're not always as good. I mean, as readers, we're very discretionary. You know, we like what we like. And if you read a book and you don't like it, there's nothing you can do about that.
No, there's not, other than, you know, sort of grumble and complain and wonder whether you're going to read the next one or not. So, you know, authors think about that, too. And as I'm writing a story, it's not... I found the best formula for me, if I have a formula, is that I don't write for my readers so much as I write for myself. Because I feel like if I'm really interested in the material and I'm gung-ho and passionate about it and I'm flying through the pages because I really want to write this story, then all that's going to come through in the pages in the story. And the reader's going to go, wow, this guy was really into that story. And I can tell that he was really wanted to write it because I'm really enjoying it. Rather than the writer saying, oh, I got another book due. What am I going to write about? What I think people might want to read.
Right.
Then you jump into the bad formula. Instead of saying, how can I do something differently? How can I be fresh? You say, I wonder how I did it last time. You know, and I can just kind of change the names a little bit and get by again with the same plot rehash. So that's a problem you never want to fall into.
What was the hardest thing about writing The Sixth Man? Were there any, I mean, when you see the plot, you know the plot, and you have it in your head, do you know the ending? Do you know the middle? Or does it happen as you write it?
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, I sort of explore, take the same journey the reader does when they're reading the book as I'm writing it. I'm not really sure how it's going to play out. There's so many different scenarios. It's almost like, you know, infinite number of mathematical calculations you can make. I could go this way, this way, this way, this way, and I could have ended it myriad ways. So as you get closer to the end, you sort of have to figure out, how do I want to end this? Who's going to be left standing? Where's the big twist going to come from? Who am I going to lay the blame on? Now, as you get closer to the ending, obviously, you have to go back and foreshadow things and make things consistent. If you want to lay the blame on a particular person, you have to make sure that you were fair with the reader and you laid clues here and there for them to be able to unturn. So I do all of that as well. But for me, it's a journey, and I don't have an outline that tells me everything I'm going to write. I kind of just let it fly some days and wing it. It's a spontaneous craft, so spontaneity is not such a bad thing. It really gets your creative juices going. If I challenge myself to sit down one day and I have no idea what I'm going to write about, it makes my imagination and my mind work much more sharply, much more clearly, instead of looking at an outline saying, oh, yeah, this is what I'm going to write today. Thanks.
Right. But, you know, we've seen you, and you have, like, I think the number is 110 million copies of your books in print, which is just a staggering number of books.
Right, I know.
But is it hard now? Is it... I mean, Absolute Power is what really got you started, what really got you off the ground running.
Yeah.
But is it as hard to write now as it was then, or do you find it easier in some ways?
It's easier in some ways in that, you know, when I go out and research, I don't really have to tell people who I am and why I want to talk to them. A lot of people want to come to me and, you know, they have specialized knowledge. They're in an agency or a police force or whatever. They're very happy to talk to me.
That must be cool to be able to do that.
Oh, it is. It is very cool when you have agencies call up and say, and gee, we'd love to be in one of your books, you know, come and talk to us. So the downside to it is that there's, you know, when I was just starting out, I wrote in total obscurity. Nobody was, you know, calling me up. Well, nobody wanted me to appear here or there. Nobody wanted me to do this or that. So really, I have to fight these days to, you know, have time to write, as crazy as it sounds. And I know that some people think that writers just kind of sit around in their pajamas until they have a book that comes out, but that's really not the case. The demands of my time are just enormous, and that's why I have a staff, that's why I have an office to try to act as a buffer zone and why my schedule is so tight. But that's the big downside. And I obviously wouldn't give my success away for anything. I work very hard for it, but it's a lot harder than you would think finding time to write when you're an established popular author, because everybody kind of wants a piece of you.
Now, you have a very good sense of humor, as I've heard coming to your signing. Your humor is, I mean, people remember that. People still talk about when you came in and how funny you were. Yeah. I'm wondering, did you and Michael Connelly come up with these numbers? I mean, he's got 5 and you have 6.
That was totally a coincidence, but it must have been somehow predestined. That's all I can think of, is that Mike and I were on the same channel there. Because when I finished The Sixth Man and, you know, sent it up to the publisher, and then, you know, you start looking on Amazon months later to see what books are coming out. out, and there was Mike's at Fifth Witness. I was like, oh, I'm glad I didn't name it the Seventh Man or the Fourth Man. You know,
I saw that, and I thought, I'll bet they got together and decided, I'll do five, you do six.
I know, it was crazy. Absolutely. I'm sure Mike's probably thinking the same thing, because, and we came out a couple of weeks apart, so it was, and even in the correct order, so you never know. That's one of those things that I wrote, if I wrote it in the book, nobody would believe it.
Right, and you're both super nice guys.
I love Mike. He's a great guy.
And I love this. I love the look of your books too. Your books always have this wonderful look. Like The Sixth Man is red. Of course, red's my favorite color. But there's just something about whoever does the style of your books really does a great job of them, and they just always look so cool.
Yeah, and it's title. You know, the covers are important, and I think the art department does a really good job. I work with them closely on covers. I have ideas for how I'd like the books to look. I like a little bit of punch, but I like it to be clean and classical. I don't want too much stuff on there that kind of gets in the way of the cover.
I have to ask you, what's in the six, though? I can't figure out what it is in the number six.
Yeah, we kind of did that intentionally. We wanted it to be a reflection, sort of like a reflection of things that looked a little bit familiar, but you still can't distinguish what they actually are. In the earlier renditions of that cover, there was like an eye that you could see and make out, and maybe like a part of a finger that you can make out, like a person was sort of trapped in that six.
I see a fish, too.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of like a psychiatric exam. Whatever you want to look in there and see, you can sort of, you know, self-analyze yourself. So we cleaned it up a little bit and just kind of let it be enough in there to intrigue people without being overkill. That was kind of a delicate balance, too. But I think
it is intriguing.
Right,
do you know what sells the book cover? I mean, are you to the point where you know which if you have a certain look of your book cover that is going to sell more copies?
Well, what I like to do is they'll send me down a bunch of dummy jackets, and I'll wrap them around, you know, just regular books, and I'll put them face out on a wall, and I'll walk by and have my staff find, like you would walk by in a bookstore.
Right.
And if it gets lost on a shelf with other books, even face out, then I figure that's not such a good thing. If it pops, is there something intriguing either in the color, in the name of the book, or in the graphic on the book? And if it all, and ideally if it all comes together and really pops, then that's sort of a litmus test for me that, yeah, this cover is going to work. Because even though I'm well known and I have a big fan base, you know, you're always looking for new readers and what's going to grip that reader. I'll go into bookstores. I go to bookstores all the time just to buy books, and my wife does, my kids do, and I'll see a cover that really grabs me. I'll remember that and say that was a really interesting take. That's a really interesting graphic. I like how they worked that out. And you know, I'll call the publisher up and say, go check that book out. You know, just for future down the road. Not like we'd ever copy a cover, but you know, that's a fresh approach. And you know, you may want to think about, you know, sort of outside the box about that for next time. So.
And of course, the title, The Sixth Man, just like right away you think, well, what does that mean, The Sixth Man? What? I mean, right away you're conjuring up ideas in your head as the reader. You know, I want to open that book and see what it's all about.
Oh, absolutely. And the titles are important, and that one sort of came to me early on. Sometimes they come later in the process, but as soon as I said The Sixth Man, everybody really loved that. And I was at the book signing somewhere a few weeks ago, and the guy who had read the book said, you know, where'd the title come from? Because in the book it's the E6 program. And I said, well, quite frankly, the E6 man doesn't sound nearly as cool. The Sixth Man. I said, sometimes it's as simple as that, and everybody laughed. But it is. It's true.
How do you stay so well grounded? I mean, it's obviously you do. I mean, just talking to you, you have a very calm presence. I mean, how do you stay that way? Aren't there days where you just want to? I mean, you're obviously happy because you're doing exactly what you want to do, and you've been very successful. But how do you stay grounded so you don't get too much of an ego or too much of a? How do you do that?
I have. Well, you know, success came to me. I wasn't 20. I wasn't 30. I mean, I was 34 when I sold my first novel, so I was pretty well grounded, and my personality was pretty much set. I've always been sort of a calm, even keel kind of guy. I mean, I can get emotional like anybody else under certain circumstances, but
right.
It's just my personality, and I'm set in my ways, I guess. So just because I became a best-selling novelist, all of a sudden I wasn't going to lose my head and go nuts. It just wasn't me. And my wife is very grounded. We both came from similar backgrounds. She would not allow my head to get big. Let me tell you that. You know, I come back from book tour. I've been on a national program, and I'm telling her about stuff. She goes, great. You know, by the way, it's trash day. Why don't you get on that, okay?
Really? That really happens?
Oh, yes.
That is terrific. But see, that's a good thing.
Oh, it's a great thing. You know, I hop off a plane, and I jump in the car, and I go watch my son play tennis. I go watch my daughter at swim meet, or I'm giving my daughter's commencement speech for high school graduation on Sunday, and I was putting the finishing touches on that speech, and I loved it. I'm so looking forward to doing it. I'm just a dad. I'm not a writer at that point. I'm just a dad who's very proud of his kid.
Right. Now, which book of yours reached number one first on the New York Times?
In paperback, Absolute Power did when the movie came out.
What was the first hardcover to reach number one?
Saving Faith.
So how does that feel when you first reach that number one? Because I've talked to authors recently who would say, well, my goal is to reach number one in the New York Times, and one of the ones I'd spoken to had reached number three.
Yeah.
And I think, what does it feel like for you when you reach number one? What's the feeling like?
Well, it is. I mean, it's kind of a cool feeling. You could be, depending on the season, you could be number two or number three and sell more copies than you did at number one if you're selling in, February as opposed to November. But everybody likes to be number one. I guess it's sort of an innate competitiveness that people have, and it's nice to have on your book, okay, number one best-selling novelist.
And it's nice that Dan Brown doesn't have a book out, so it's easier to get to number one.
Right. I know. And when J.K. Rowling was on the adult list, it was really hard to get up there, too. So.
Right.
It's a nice feeling, certainly.
But
it happens, and then it happens again and again and again, and it's still nice, but that first time, that's when you get the pop, I guess.
And there doesn't seem to be a lot of competition between authors, so you don't hear a lot of authors saying bad things about each other, But yeah. Do you feel like you have any competition in the books that you write, you're pretty stylized in what you do. I mean, everything, your style is a lot different from others.
Oh, it is, and I don't, it's certainly not, we're not out there building widgets, so it's not like saying I'm building a better product than you've got. Everybody has their own style, their own way of telling a story, so there's very little competition there. It would be difficult to compare, books even in the same genre, because, John Grisham writes books in a different way than I would write my books, or Michael Connelly, or Lee Child, or Nelson DeVille. So,
and on and on and on. There's so many now.
But, yeah, absolutely.
But to think that, you have been the success that you have been. I mean, there are authors that write and never even get noticed. That you've been noticed so much is amazing.
Yeah, and I thought, as my 30s came, and I'm reaching my middle 30s, and I really had not sold anything. I hadn't been successful, even though I've been writing for almost 20 years. I thought I would be one of those writers who was a good writer but was never going to be published just because didn't get the break, wasn't in the right place at the right time. So I went through all those emotions and feelings too, where rejection after rejection and the frustration, and I think that's one reason why I do keep so even keel, and I also like helping aspiring novelists, because I very much know what it's like to be on the other side of the glass looking in, because I was there for a long time.
It's nice when you know the bottom and then you're at the top, because then you appreciate more of what you have, I think.
Oh, I absolutely do. And I know that there are a lot of really good writers out there who deserve to be published and who aren't published for reasons that are largely beyond their control. That in and of itself is very humbling to me.
Now, I've totally lost my train of thought. I was going to ask you about your Wish You Well Foundation. Now, you help a lot of... What's the goal with that? To get more people reading, or to get books into children's hands?
It's kind of a combination of that. It's certainly to eradicate illiteracy. We have a huge illiteracy problem in the United States, and that's why so many people live in poverty, because they have low job skills. And it's not just ESL. It's a mainstream, across-the-board problem. You have high schools not graduating millions of kids every year, and they're socioeconomically doomed. They don't have the skills necessary to be self-sustaining. So we fund literacy programs across the United States. We work with a lot of national partners, Reading Volunteers of America, Pro-Literacy, and we funded programs in over 42 states and counting.
Wow.
And we give money to public school systems who don't have money for books. And we also have another program that we run called Feeding Body and Mind. And on my book tours, I have these big white boxes that go out. And other authors have joined me. Mike Connolly's done it, Brad Meltzer, Sue Grafton, Lisa Scottolini, Linda Fairstein. And the fans bring in new and used books and put them in those boxes. And once those boxes are full, we partner with Feeding America, which runs all the nation's food banks. And those boxes go to the food banks. And then those boxes go out and distribute it out in that pipeline. People go in to get food, because they need food assistance. 9 times out of 10, they're also impoverished. That's why they're seeking food assistance. And 9 times out of 10, they're impoverished because they have low job skills, low literacy skills. So they get food, and they also get books. And books being in a home can change lives. They can be very positive ways.
And it, it helps with the boredom in these kids too. I mean, how many kids are running around, you know, they're bored and they're getting into trouble, and
you
never know what they're going to get into, and to have them sitting and reading a book and enjoying it, having something to look forward to.
It's a very positive on many levels, and we've also found in our studies that oftentimes adults who can't read, they need a catalyst to sort of overcome the stigma of going and seeking an assistance to read, and a lot of times it comes from the fact when their kid is old enough, and they come into mom or dad and say, hey, can you read me this book? And if it's not a book in the house for the kid to pick up and ask their parents to read, then that catalyst is never going to happen.
Right. I mean, you think about kids and how they learn so much from reading too. I mean, it's you can tell a lot by talking to a person whether they read a lot too, because of their vocabulary. You know, if they're only using the same words over and over again, you know, they're not learning a lot. They're not reading a lot.
Absolutely.
And I have people that I've worked with who will say to me, well, it's a lot of work to read a book. They don't want to use their mind too much, I guess. And how do you feel about that? I mean, your books are pretty easy to read. I mean, you can sit and just get lost in one of your books. But do you think it's sometimes too much work to read? Have you ever find that to be true?
Well, you know, certainly it depends on what types of books. I find that kids innately sort of feel that books they were assigned to read in school are hard to read just because they didn't get to pick them.
Right.
And oftentimes that will sort of kill the spirit the kid has who wants to read a book. They feel like, oh, they associate books with sort of a negative thing. Well, okay, I got to read this book, and I really don't want to read it, but I have to because the teacher said I had to.
Or they have a list, and they want to pick the shortest book.
Right.
Just to get it. And it's really pretty sad when you think about it, that they don't have that thrill to read a book. I mean, when I first read a book in school, I remember when I got through it, I thought, wow, that was unbelievable. I can't wait to experience that again. It's that experience of reading something, enjoying it, and you actually learn things, that is just, you can't duplicate that feeling.
No, you can't. I really, you know, I commend J.K. Rowling. I mean, she really brought back a generation of readers who probably would not have been reading with the Harry Potter series, to let kids know that reading can be, you know, just enormously beneficial and fun, too. And let's not forget the fun factor. That's what got me to reading when I was a kid, that I thought it was really fun to do. But aside from just being fun, you're right, it changes the quality of your life and makes you a different person. I always find that, you know, people who read, you know, you're around them at parties and stuff, they're much better conversationalists. They know what's going on, because you extend that not just to reading fiction or nonfiction, reading newspapers, magazines, being aware of what's going on in the world.
Right.
And those people are just de facto much more interesting.
Right. I mean, there's just, when you read a great book, you know that feeling when you read a great book and you want to read another one right after it? Sometimes it's, I mean, to find that next great book is so hard sometimes. And yet, as a reader, when you love to read, you keep at it. You know you're going to find another one. It's just a question of how long it's going to take you to find it.
Yeah.
Do you feel that same way? Tell me the last great book you read.
Let's see. Fiction-wise, it was probably, I stumbled onto this fantasy series a couple of years ago, and I just finished the last one. Jasper Ford writes a literary fantasy series with this character Thursday Next. And I love the books just because he makes you believe this world is real, even though it's so out there. And it also has a lot to do with great literature, you know, where you have a detective that can jump into Wuthering Heights and ferret out evil there. It was both clever, well-researched, and enormously entertaining. Those types of books, you know, I just love to read, where it's just something new and something just totally different. And I can tell how hard the writer has worked to make this entertainment.
And that's the point with a writer. They have to make it believable. If it's not believable, I mean, I as a reader, I get very angry when the characters are not three-dimensional.
You do. You really get... Characters are the only way you really can connect with readers on a human level. The plot is the plot. But you have to build these characters so they feel real on the page, because the readers have to care about them. You know, I could build a great plot and inhabit it with mediocre characters, and your reader's not going to care because whether the characters live or die. You know?
Have you ever thought of a really great plot in your head, but then weren't able to make a book out of it? Has that ever happened?
Oh, yeah. I mean, some ideas in your head are sort of a dime a dozen. They sound great in your head. And then when you start sort of fleshing it out and thinking, okay, I'm going to write this into a 450-page novel, sometimes it just doesn't hold up. You know, it's kind of like a bridge with a weak foundation. Everything starts to collapse. And then you just go back and think of something else to work on. But that's all part of a sort of a trial and error. that's what spontaneity is. Sometimes it hits, sometimes it doesn't hit. And you go back to the drawing board and rework something else. So, yeah, every writer, I think, goes through that.
Right. When do you start thinking about next year's books? I mean, when you obviously will have two more next year, I'm assuming you will.
Yeah.
I mean, when do you start, when do the ideas of those books, now I assume Zero Day's almost done, you must be done by now.
Yeah, I'm close to the end of Zero Day, and I've started to think about the book for the spring, what I'd like it to be. I think it's going to be a standalone again, not bringing back a series, and sort of just taking on a different tack on something, you know, a different sort of plot that I never really attempted before, seeing where it goes. So that's the fun part for me. It's just not knowing where the next step is going to be, but it's going to be sort of a fresh step.
Right, and that's what makes you interesting, the fact that we don't know what's coming next from you. We can't say, well, I know what the next book's going to be about. It's going to be about this and this and this. Because there are some authors that you know practically every book's going to be different names of characters, but almost the same kind of plot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a woman in trouble, maybe it's a man in trouble. But yours, we never quite know what's coming next. And that must be fun to do as an author, not when the readers can't second-guess you.
Right.
They can't say, well, I know what he's going to write next. It's going to be just like the last book.
You know, that's right. No, they can't. You know, they really can't second guess me on that because it's, well, you know, with One Summer coming out, not a thriller. You know, the only reason I wrote One Summer is my son has a confirmation December of last year. My wife sent me to the church early to save seats, and I had like an hour to kill, and this idea for One Summer hit me. It's kind of like, you know, just unspooled in my head, and I spent the next 2 months obsessively writing it and didn't know I was going to do it. Certainly the readers are not going to be able to expect it because until I went to the church and sat down and kind of had an hour to kill, I didn't know I was going to write it either. So that was definitely a spontaneous sort of spur-of-the-moment thing that was really a fluke.
Now, that's going to be like what do they call it, mainstream fiction? Or?
Yeah, it is. It's commercial fiction, but it's not a thriller. It's a family drama. And
I don't understand all the fiction terms. Sometimes I get confused with myself.
They're all crazy anyway. I don't know what they mean either.
I mean, you write thrillers, but sometimes a lot of times your books are mysteries, too. So, I mean, they can be put in either section and be right. You know, it's a question of what the bookstore person who owns the store would actually think of what they are.
Right.
And, you know, we always have that problem at work. You know, is it a mystery? Is it a thriller? But speaking of mysteries, you're also doing a book with a bunch of different authors. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I did it. It's No Rest for the Dead. I did the introduction for it. They sort of have an all-star lineup of writers.
Are you writing part of the story too?
Or is no, it just... I did the introduction. So
okay.
I was able to sort of look at all what they were doing and the lineup, and a lot of them were my friends. And
What's the basic plot? What's the basic gist of the book? I mean, is it a...
It really is kind of almost like a closed room mystery, you know, a murder where you have to figure out who did it. So it's far more kind of a Agatha Christie-esque murder mystery than it is a thriller that I might have written. But it's got an all-star lineup of writers, and I think they really seamlessly sort of went from chapter to chapter and handed off, you know, like a football and kept going, and they all got the theme of the story, and it really worked very well. So I thought that was fun to be able to do something like that. And when they asked me to write the introduction, I was glad to do it because I like promoting things like that.
Now, when you're not writing, what can we, would we see you on the golf course? Would we see you playing tennis? What would we see you doing?
Yeah, you'd see me playing tennis with my kids. They were both very good tennis players. You'd see me boating a lot, water skiing, wakeboarding, sailing. We have a summer house in Southern Virginia. Just got back from there from Memorial Day. A lot of friends down there, and I'm active in the community down there. And,
now, I've actually met your kids. When I came to the book festival in D.C., I met...
Oh, yeah, okay.
Your kids were sitting right to either side of you, and I wish I had taken a picture of it, because it was so wonderful to see them, so that, you know, there in front of you, there with you.
Yeah,
you know, Daddy can do both, you know?
Exactly.
But they're just so cute. Your kids were adorable, and it was just nice to see that togetherness and to feel that, yeah, Dad really does care about his kids. You know, I got to go to work, you got to stay home kind of thing. He can bring the kids with him, and that really is a great feeling.
No, it is. Absolutely.
Because I'm sure you don't get an awful lot of time with them and with all the work that you're doing.
No, I know. I have to work hard to spend time with them, and, you know, I do, but it's not as easy as it, you know, probably should be. But the moments we have together are, you know, really good quality moments, and, you know, spending time down at the lake house, it's just us and having fun together. It's really magical.
Okay, so The Sixth Man is out now, and I assume it's made number one by now?
Yeah, it was number one 2 weeks in a row.
That's great. So what are your goals at this point? Do you have goals, or is it just writing and enjoying and trying to make a better book each time? What's the goal?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to continue to write thrillers and non-thrillers. I consider myself just a writer, not any particular genre. I have some business interests, some alternative energy companies I'm invested in, and trying to push those forward into getting them out into the market.
You're giving back a lot, too, which is really wonderful to see.
Yeah, I mean, we take our charitable endeavors very seriously, and the Wish You Well Foundation has been around for 8 years, and we'll continue to keep going. We have a full-time executive director to help run that, and we're always expanding that program, always getting new partnerships in. I've been dabbling in some independent film production where I help finance a picture that Jane Seymour was in that'll be out on television next year. And
what's the name of it so we can look for it?
Lake Effects. Lake Effects. EFFECTS.
Why does that title sound familiar?
It's probably been on the internet around. I mean, it's got a lot of buzz in Hollywood just because we got a lot of named talent. We shot it for a very low budget, but, you know, got a lot of great character actors to come and appear in it. And
Did you get to meet them all?
I met some of them. Yeah,
that's great. So you have your hand in so many different things. It must be fun. It's like, what do I do today?
Well, I have a lot of people who approach me. I had a meeting last week with the Dave Matthews Band has a film component where they do distribution and production, and they came up to meet with me to possibly do some work together. I have the book I wrote called Wish You Well, sort of my To Kill a Mockingbird,
which has done very well, and it's on all the school lists every year.
And so I'm working to put together an independent film production of that book as well. That'll be filmed for theatrical release. So.
Tell me, now we'll take tomorrow, for instance. What will you do? How much writing will you do tomorrow?
Tomorrow is kind of a special day for me. My mother passed away recently.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
So tomorrow is a memorial service for her. So I'll be down in Richmond for that. So tomorrow is just, you know, the time for that, and the day after that, I've got, you know, some phone calls. I've got some meetings. My assistants keep my calendar really, really well, so I've got everything listed on it by day, by, you know, how long the phone call is, how long the meeting is, but the next, you know, I've got meetings and stuff pretty much every day the next weeks, and then I go on book tour for one summer on the 18th.
Just got back from a book tour.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
my daughter's graduation, but I'm going to be writing throughout that because the next 2 or 3 weeks, really, I'll be finishing up Zero Day to get it up to the publisher, and, you know, I want to get that wrapped up, and I go to Europe in July for a book tour.
45 countries you're in. It's amazing.
Yeah. The Sick Man just hit number one in Holland, hit number one in Australia, hit number one in New Zealand, too.
Oh,
so,
my gosh.
I was shortlisted for this ITV Thriller Prize in England. I was shortlisted with one of 6 novelists voted on by the public to be the Crime Writer of the Year. And
not to be confused with ITW in the States here, right?
That's right. Not to be confused with ITW. Totally separate. So,
Sure you go to every year, right?
Oh, it's great. Yeah, I was one of the founding patrons of that, and that's Steve Barry and a bunch of the people who started it, and it's a great organization.
Right. Now, I'm looking forward to, you mentioned Sue Grafton. You must know Sue Grafton.
I do, yeah. I had dinner at Sue's house years ago in Louisville. She maintains a home in Louisville, and she's also in California. She's a very sweet lady. I liked her a lot.
I must tell you a story. I'm trying to get an interview with Sue Grafton. So
okay.
Well, maybe you could put in a good word for me.
Yeah, okay. She had a great interview. I mean, she's a great lady.
You don't hear her interviewed very often. It's very...
You know, she's just very reclusive that way.
I'm very much looking forward to her new book in the fall that's coming.
Me too. I read all of her books. I emailed her one time and told her, when she agreed to help us on Feeding Body and Mind, I emailed her and said I'd spent one summer, I started with A and worked my way through all of her novels again. I'd read them before, and I was able, for a while, I was able to recite all the titles just from memory.
Right. You know, I can actually recite a lot of them too. I have. It's funny how they all stick in your head.
They do. No, she's an excellent writer.
But the funny thing is, if somebody asked me about your books, I could probably name 10 of them right off the bat. I mean, your books are always memorable titles, which is nice.
Yeah, we try hard with that. You know, titles are hard sometimes. We try to get it right, though.
Now, I know you have to go, unfortunately. It's been a great time talking to you. And The Sixth Man is out in hardcover, and as you say, number one all over the place, including the United States. I'm so honored to have you on the show. I really am. It's been a pleasure.
Great. I always enjoy talking to you. I mean, it's great to spend time with somebody who loves books and reading and sort of gets what really is important about books.
I have to ask you one thing, though. On your cover, is that your house on the back that you're standing next to?
Oh, with a picture?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is. It's sort of the rear grounds of our house up in northern Virginia. It's kind of like a pavilion thing. Yep.
That's interesting. I always wonder, where do they take that picture? You know? Readers are always curious. I mean, they wouldn't be readers, you know?
Yeah.
And, of course,
exactly.
you're curious, too, because you're working on the next plot.
That's right.
Thank you so much, David Baldacci. The book, again, is called The Sixth Man, and this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.